Hello, Mr. Mnuchin.
Yes, hello, I'm Steven Mnuchin.
Hi, it's Peter De Beer. I contacted you about getting an expert opinion on our most recent podcast episode.
Yes, I read your email and listened to that episode.
Oh, that's great. Would you like to introduce yourself, first of all, for our listeners?
Sure, I'm Steven Mnuchin, Secretary of Treasury. I have a long and illustrious career in finance. I'm the executive producer of many popular films such as Sully and Suicide Squad, and I'm a member of Kamala Harris's Bay Hive.
That's impressive. So what were your thoughts on our description of how prices work?
Well, to me, it sounds like you're describing communism. Communism doesn't work.
I mean, we didn't really talk about communism. The whole episode was about capitalism.
I'm going to explain this to you, okay? Communism, eating pizza with other people perfectly explains why communism doesn't work. One, not all slices are the same. Some slices are bigger than others, and some have more toppings than others. Rationally, everyone wants the biggest slice with the most toppings, but not everyone can get the biggest slice. You need to have some way of deciding who gets the biggest slices and who gets the smallest slices. Sharing pizza with others always leads to mass death because no one is willing to take a smaller slice voluntarily. Two, not everyone likes the same toppings. What if I want onions, but everyone else wants pepperoni? Under communism, shared pizza, everyone gets the same things, toppings, but inevitably some people, me, will be disappointed. Under capitalism, we each get our own slice with whatever toppings we want, so I can get onions while everyone else gets pepperoni. This is why capitalism is so great.
Mr. Mnuchin, Mr. Mnuchin,
Three,
I'm really
central planning doesn't work. Continuing on the last point, what would happen if our hypothetical group delegated all the decisions on pizza to one person, like in communism? We would end up with something no one wanted, like a small, thin crust, half with anchovies and no cheese, and half with pineapple and black olives. Also, the delivery boy people and the people at the pizza place would all die of starvation.
Mr. Mnuchin, listen, this isn't really
Look,
about
you asked me a question, so can I answer it?
I didn't.
Four. You might have three people sharing eight slices. You can't divide eight evenly by three. Under communism, there would be no incentive to make pizza cutters because there's no profit or competition. That means two people will get three slices, while one will only get two. And of course, it's always going to be the hardest working people, like me, who only get two slices. Five. Sharing pizza requires the creation of a pizza bureaucracy. If you don't decide how many slices each person gets through market-based processes like me and my many cool friends, then you have to create a pizza bureaucracy where party functionaries decide how much pizza you get, as well as what toppings it has, what kind of crust you get, and whether or not you're allowed to dip the crust in marinara sauce. Six, the pie is fixed. Under communism, pizzas are a fixed size and have to be shared evenly. But under capitalism, we don't have a fixed pie. Entrepreneurs can grow the size of the pizza by taking risks, which they are rewarded for by getting more or bigger slices. Communism doesn't provide any incentive to grow the size of the pie, because if they do, it will all go to the pizza bureaucracy. Seven, you can't prevent the creation of black markets. Garlic sauce is a scarce resource. And when people have to compete for scarce resources, markets are the result. If you try to outlaw garlic sauce markets, you will just get garlic sauce black markets. So you see, communism doesn't lead to freedom or justice. It leads to mass starvation, pizza bureaucracies, and pineapple with olives.
Okay. Well, let me just say, I disagree with pretty much every point you've made, but I still have no idea why you've made this about communism. It's almost like you didn't read my email or listen to the show, and were put up as a mouthpiece, being paid to harp on about communism and... Great, he hung up. Well, everyone, that was Stevie Mnuchin, the idiot responsible for Suicide Squad. Thanks, Stevie.
Neighbor science and Grandpa Pokchin. Neighbor science school and Grandpa Pokchin rule. Neighbor science and Grandpa Pokchin are our own.
Hey everyone, welcome to Neighbor Science, episode number 4, and today we're going to be discussing energy. But before we do, we've managed to get a nice little interview from the Secretary of Treasury for the Trump administration.
We've been doing activism.
Yeah, real activism for once, you know. And
we are political agents. We're political agents of change. Hashtag resistance.
And also, I just wanted to give a quick little update saying why we haven't really been doing that many podcasts recently. I've been changing jobs quite a bit, doing a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and in preparation for the latest job, I've had to do a lot of research, and I got very involved, and I've been a little bit too busy to focus my attention on the real-world problems like capitalism.
Yeah, man. I went on a two-week trip to the UK, so my first vacation in, like, I don't know, 7 years, something like that. And when I got back, what I thought was a four-week deadline until this major release that I'm working on by myself turned out to be a two-week deadline. So I've been working weekends and late nights and everything to try and get ahead of that.
Nice. So we can finally get back to what's really important.
Yes. The true important things, describing obscure theories about race realism and energy.
Okay. So what we're going to be discussing today, it's a very big topic. So we're looking at maybe breaking this down into two separate podcasts. Hopefully you'll tune in for both. Today we're going to be discussing energy sources, sustainability versus unsustainability. We're going to be talking about different storage mechanisms, but essentially, over the next two episodes, we will be focusing predominantly on energy.
That's right. All right, so let's get right into it. So first, we wanted to talk about sustainability because that's kind of the whole point of talking about energy. Is, you know, we have plenty of it now. As Peter found out yesterday or the day before, we're in no danger of running out of fossil fuels before we, like, trash the planet. So the really important thing is that we change our energy mix and our energy habits to make sure that we don't trash the planet.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not looking like we're going to run out of anything before we screw it all up. And the major reason for this is the fact that there are a lot of advances happening in the oil, coal, and other fossil fuel sectors. So while we have been over-consuming, the problem is not that we're going to run out because of consumption. The problem is how much pollution we're putting out because of consumption. And with all the advances being made in the fossil fuel sectors, it's not looking like there's going to be any scaling back anytime soon, despite big talks by Paris Climate Accords and national governments and all that jazz.
Yeah, before my hope was that, you know, even though technology was getting better, technology can't get better forever, so there would still be some sort of peak. And so the peak oil theory would still be true, but this isn't just like if technology keeps progressing, then we're going to trash the ecosystem. This is like the amount of fossil fuels that we have available to us now due to advances in technology will, with just proven reserves, will trash the biosphere. I remember reading something else about this where it's like 80% of proven fossil fuel reserves have to stay in the ground in order for 2 degrees of climate change to be avoided.
Indeed.
And proven reserves are very low compared to, like, the
what's
actual...
what's actually in the ground.
Proven reserves is just, like, a measure for investors in energy to know, like, how steady their income stream is going to be.
Exactly. So I think before we move on, before we talk to get too deeply in this, let's talk about how to define sustainability. I know that the standard dictionary definition says that in ecology, sustainability, which is taken from obviously the ability to sustain, is the property of biological systems to remain diverse and productive indefinitely. But obviously with us looking at more obscure economic theories...
We like the unusual ideas.
Because we like the unusual ideas, I know you've been working with a slightly different definition. So maybe you'd like to talk us through that.
Yeah, so I mean, my favorite one has always been, there's this paper, it's been updated several times, and each time it's had more and more authors added onto it. So the original one was by, like, 9 people. The lead author was Johan Rockström. It's basically a bunch of ecologists and ecological economists. It's called Planetary Boundaries, and it defines sustainability as being about staying within a set of explicit and definable boundaries for the ecosystem. So the original one only had 7 boundaries. The newest edition has 9. So some of them are pretty obvious, like climate change, biosphere integrity, which just means like the species diversity. So we want to avoid causing mass extinction. I think that's a pretty good goal. Ocean acidification, which is like the less well-known younger sibling of climate change. It's basically caused by the same things. Carbon dioxide dissolves into the ocean, changes the pH, which poses a danger to sea life and underwater ecosystems. Oh, well, actually, another well-known one would be ozone depletion, which is actually the only planetary boundary where we've gone, you know, outside the boundary and recovered. So it's like the one hope that humanity has, kind of thing. And then there's less well-known ones like land system change, which is basically the amount of land that we're using as opposed to letting it be wild, or at least like a host for an ecosystem. And then like freshwater use, which is the amount of water we're taking out of the water cycle. And that's actually a pretty major issue, if I remember correctly. Although I'm looking at the chart now and it seems fine. And then there's biogeochemical flows, which that's probably only known well in like agriculture, which is important agricultural minerals, phosphorus and nitrogen. Nitrogen is produced from, I think, from petrol byproducts, and phosphorus is just mined as like a mineral. And so nitrogen is actually being overloaded in certain areas of the ecosystem. Basically, where agricultural wastes go, there's an extreme abundance of nitrogen, and it causes things like algae blooms. It can cause anoxia events. I think it's usually caused by an algae bloom, but the basic idea is that all the oxygen underwater gets depleted, and so all the sea life dies suddenly. And that's actually what caused one of the major mass extinction events, was like a large-scale ocean anoxia.
Well, it's a good thing. It's a really good thing we're not in the 6th mass extinction. Oh, wait.
Yeah. Yeah, so that whole biosphere integrity thing, we're doing a very bad job there.
Yeah, ocean acidification is...
also bad.
See, the problem with ocean acidification is that it has so many knock-on effects. Mm-hmm. I remember about over the last 2 months, there's been a ridiculous amount of articles being published online about the Great Barrier Reef.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And how most of it is now being declared dead. The World Heritage Foundation has declared that it's an absolute catastrophe. Pretty much every scientist that's going anywhere near it is in tears about it, because the knock-on effects when the world's most robust, long-lived biodiverse reef dies, it's incalculable. There's really absolutely no way. And the only reason that it's happening is because of the acidifying oceans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ocean acidification, it's a direct byproduct of climate change. There seems to be a big misconception whenever I hear people talk about climate change. They assume that we're talking about the air heating up. And yes, right. there is an air temperature rise, and it's being measured.
There's been a hiatus. Global warming hiatus. No one wants you to know about.
Yeah. Except, I love talking to climate deniers about this, because then when you go
Shout
and look at
Brandon.
The actual... We love you, Brandon. When I talk to climate deniers and climate skeptics about this, they're usually very quick to point out that the hiatus has happened and the air temperatures have stalled, but they're not taking into account the fact that a lot of the heat uptake has happened in the ocean. And
yeah, I think it's like way more of it, because, I mean, the ocean obviously has... Since it's water, water can store a lot more heat than air can.
And it does this by increasing the tidal flows, the streams in the deep ocean. It pulls in all this energy, and all these streams and I'm actually using the wrong word right now. The currents pick up their pace. And this can only happen because there's a bigger energy uptake. That bigger energy uptake is a direct example of heat exchange. And as the oceans are heating up, their ability to deal with the amount of carbon being absorbed by the oceans changes drastically. Mm-hmm. And so ocean acidification becomes this feedback loop of everything terrible. So that's the
big problem with planetary boundaries. Like, it's a good framework, but because we're dealing with ecosystems, there's all these interactions between all these different metrics. And so you can't look at it as like a specific, like an individual metric. Like, it's hard to set the boundaries in the first place, because as climate change gets worse, or as ocean acidification gets worse, then the boundary for the other becomes smaller.
Yeah. There are very strong knock-on effects. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think a big part of this, I didn't know about the concept until maybe about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think the first time that I picked up on it was through you, was the notion of an emergy budget. Mm-hmm. And please note that I'm now using the letter M for Mary and not N for Nelly when I'm saying emergy. The emergy budget is essentially Earth's energy budget. It is a look at how much energy are we taking in from the sun, how much gets allocated to different cycles throughout the planet, and there are millions, and then how much of it is radiated back out into space. Now, human beings have a very specific portion of that energy budget that we are capable of utilizing for our own purposes. And what's happened is that steadily, since the 1700s, we have allocated more and more and more of that energy budget that is supposed to go towards other planetary systems to our own ends. And the more that we do that, the more we break down all those other planetary systems.
Right.
So we've got these the final boundaries. And we are literally destroying them one by one. We're taking up more and more of those different budgets for our own ends, so that we can...
Mostly for corn.
Exactly. Corn and steroids for livestock.
Yes. Yeah, and that's part of what the whole land use boundary is. Because if you want to harvest energy, then ultimately you're depending on land.
Yeah. I said a while back that if your replenishment rate and your production use time and your life cycle of the products that you're making and using, the resources that you're using, if those aren't in balance, you're not sustainable. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. And fossil fuels, by far, are the most ridiculously unsustainable things that we have. It takes millions of years to produce that fossil fuel, and we're literally using it up in a matter of days.
Right.
So, yeah, there's a heavy imbalance. Okay, so just getting back on track very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk more about MRG in the second part. By the way.
Yeah. So I just wanted to very quickly summarize your definition, or can we call it the transferix definition?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so you said that it is.
Yeah, it's a resource that can fulfill demand for something like energy without depleting any other resources or causing eco-social harm. And eco-social is obviously just a portmanteau of ecology and social. So I'm sort of using the Bookchinite concept of ecology, where human society is just a subset of ecology. And
indeed,
you know, nature as we think of it is really first nature, and humans and the anthrosphere is second nature. So we're really part of nature, but we're a sort of characteristically different part of nature. That was a long rant to explain one word.
Yeah, no, definitely, I agree.
Sustainability won't happen by itself. Fossil fuels will cause ecological disaster before we run out of them. So we need to come up with a different thing.
And so we move on to...
I'm an innovator. I wake up every morning and ask myself, what simple problem could I solve to make the world marginally more tolerable for the upper middle class, in an absurd way that makes sci-fi nerds and tech industry losers cream their pants? Usually that problem involves getting from A to B. I've created SpaceX, Tesla, the Hyperloop, and my recent proposal to build a massive system of elaborate tunnels under LA for individual cars to drive from your condo downtown to the airport, which I understand is what causes most traffic. So last week, there I was going from A, Earth, to B, space, in my private spacecraft that I built myself to test the effects of microgravity on large piles of money, when I had an inspiring new idea. In the Bay Area, we're perpetually having this housing problem, which anyone with a working knowledge of basic economics can tell you is caused exclusively by supply and demand. There are loads of gross poor people that barely own any companies, always complaining about skyrocketing rents. So I thought, what if we could use Silicon Valley's expertise in disruption to create autonomous robots? Connected by some sort of netsphere that could alleviate the supply problem of housing by simply building it without human intervention. We could improve housing construction rates by at least a factor of 7.6. There are many proofs of concept, which I built myself, which show that robots can build basic housing without human aid. Even better would be if the robots could build themselves, and again, we have proof of concept such as Repra, which I invented. If the robots were to build themselves, then you could further push the construction rates by at least two orders of magnitude. With the addition of practical new technologies like CRISPR, we can make control of what gets built seamless, using our DNA as an interface with a sort of net terminal gene. This sounds outlandish, but I've personally done the math and found that it would cost two orders of magnitude and a factor of eight less than the existing construction industry.
Okay, so after that wonderful speech by Elon Musk.
Yeah, that was our exclusive at a TED talk. We had exclusive recording rights, so you actually will not see it on the TED website, unfortunately.
Thank God.
It's only through this podcast.
Only through this podcast, and he's actually contacted us in private to commend us for praising him.
Yeah, I'd use my tech industry connections for this one, everyone. So be thankful.
Yeah.
I've expended a lot of social capital.
And we all know that he is the greatest man in existence ever.
The Lee Sin El Gaib.
Yeah, just because of the love that Elon Musk has and because of his great, wonderful ideas, I just thought it's very important to point out that despite a year ago him bringing out that wonderful, amazing, how much did it weigh? Like 40 kilos or something, lithium battery.
Oh, I never saw the weight.
Yeah, the gigantic cell phone battery that would go on your wall.
The energy sculpture.
The energy sculpture, the power wall. He brought it out a year ago, and there was the big energy factory that he was going to set up and the Giga Factory, that's what it was called. Yep. Such amazing naming he has for all his stuff. just for those that are not aware, he's cancelled it. And the reason he's cancelled it is because the economics aren't quite attractive enough. So,
just to be clear, it's not all of the power walls. It's just the large one, like the largest size.
Yeah. No, the largest size, the one that actually makes a fucking difference.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's the 10 kilowatt version, which was supposed to be installed in residences globally and was pre-ordered for months in advance and cost literally the price of a third world home.
Well, I mean, that's because it looks exactly like something you would see in like Le Poisson Rouge. It's art. You don't get it because you're not rich enough. Sorry, Peter.
Yeah, it's true.
Richer than you, so I have a better understanding of what the value is of the battery.
You're right. My poordom has affected my ability to subjectively have a subjective opinion.
Yeah. If you took a hot shower for like 3 hours, you might start to understand, but it would go away immediately as soon as you got out into the dirt trap that is your house. Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. Also, I don't have one of those the silver infused geysers that that I could then have the 3 hour shower in.
No,
so yeah,
it's true.
Okay, so yeah, I just wanted to make mention of the fact that the great guru himself basically decided that he wasn't really all about saving the world and improving the material conditions of people that are reliant on fossil fuels. He's actually more about making money.
Yeah, it's crazy. Billionaires like money a lot.
Yeah, I don't get it. They've already got so much of it. Why do they want more?
I know. Why does Iron Man need more money?
Exactly. Why isn't he starting up the Avengers with him and Bezos and...
I mean, if he were, he wouldn't tell everyone about it, obviously. He'd need to have a secret identity.
Now all I can do is picture Jeff Bezos as Captain America all dressed up with a shield that he purchased on Amazon.
I mean, it's ridiculous to think that Elon would be the superhero guy, because all of the superheroes, their secret identity is that they're like regular asshole billionaires. Like Bruce Wayne was just a normal douchebag. Tony Stark is a normal douchebag. So obviously the real superhero is Travis Kalanick.
Sorry, that reference goes missing on me. I'm not as up to date on the billionaire list as you are.
He's the CEO of Uber that was recently deposed being a giant
douchebag. Oh, yes.
He literally lost his job because he was a giant douchebag.
Okay, so up next, I think we are discussing...
Energy sources.
Energy sources,
yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Yes. we get to the meat.
Yeah, the meat of the program. We're going to start off with wind and solar because those are the obviously best options. Kind of a no-brainer that wind and solar are good. If you think that wind is bad because it kills birds or something like that, or that solar is not economically viable, you might want to just tune out now. We're not even going to go over that. Those are not real weaknesses of those energy sources.
They really are not. And it's funny because it's the only argument I ever see against wind is that they kill birds. And I'm like, yeah.
Cats kill 3 billion birds a year.
And and strangely enough, there are still birds. At the rate that cats are increasing, though, I'm not sure how much longer that might be. Anyway, currently Wind makes up what percentage of America's energy use?
4%.
4%. That's insane.
Yeah,
because you guys
small.
Literally have, and I'm pretty sure America is number one in the world for the production of wind energy.
Right, just because we use the most energy of anyone in the world.
By far.
Yeah, but the UK, for example, they do significantly better. I think it's 17% of their energy mix is wind, and I definitely noticed that on my trip there, especially around Scotland. There's nothing but windmills everywhere. And, I mean, contrary to all the people who say they're an eyesore, I think they look pretty cool.
I absolutely love them. I absolutely love them. Obviously, there are minor issues involved with windmills. Unfortunately, aesthetics is a subjective issue.
Yeah.
It's an art issue. At the end of the day, you can't please everyone with your art. But I don't think that people's subjective aesthetic opinions should have any bearing on what we use to source the energy that we use on a daily basis.
Yeah, I mean, not killing everything is maybe a little bit more important than whether or not you have a perfectly clear view of the ocean.
I know that here in Bahrain, there's a landmark building that was constructed here about a decade ago. And what makes it stand out is that it's these two triangular towers that are linked by a series of bridges between them, and actually mounted on the building itself are two gigantic wind turbines.
Okay.
And the building is beautiful. It really is one of those that sort of, it catches the eye. It's absolutely amazing. But there's a little issue. In the 7 months that I've now been in Bahrain, I have never once seen either of the two turbines moving.
Oh, I just pulled up pictures of it. Yeah, that's cool. I can Google Bahrain wind turbine building. Apparently it's the Bahrain World Trade Center. That's what the building's called.
It's very impractical. And because of its impracticality, it doesn't get used much. But then it's only supposed to deliver energy to that building.
Okay.
So part of the problem actually isn't that there isn't enough wind or anything like that. They're having trouble selling the space inside the buildings. And while there's no one in the buildings, there's only a very few people inside the buildings, while there's a low occupancy in the buildings, it's not justified to switch them on.
Oh, and so they actually turn them off. It's not just that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's plenty of wind in the area. I mean, the winds that push through, it is an island. Uh-huh. So we've got strong winds that push through on a regular basis. But you don't need ridiculously strong winds for wind turbines to work. What's interesting for me here is that the wind turbine issue really does have a lot to do with usage. If you don't need it, you don't have to use it.
Right.
Unlike your oil and your coal sources, where the moment that you stop that flow of energy, to start it back up again costs a ridiculous amount of money. To stop it costs a ridiculous amount of money. And the companies that own these coal plants and these refineries, and they can't afford to have any downtime.
Yeah, and then wind turbines, they can actually basically be throttled. And I know a lot of times, the wind blows so hard that it can't handle all of the energy coming in, so they actually just like kind of feather it and just let the energy go to waste.
Another issue that obviously comes up a lot with people talking about the limits of wind technology is the statement that because wind is intermittent, you can't guarantee the flow and that it doesn't produce enough energy. That, to me, is the most ridiculous one. I think you were the one that found it, that one turn of the blade can power a home for 29 hours.
That was like one of the big wind turbines in the UK. Yeah, no, like, I mean, the intermittent thing is a valid criticism. Like, yes, wind sometimes doesn't blow, but the point is, you build enough generators so that you can smooth out the amount of power that's used throughout the day. So you pair it with storage, pair it with transmission, and you build more wind turbines than you necessarily need. Like if you build
three times the amount of wind turbines in terms of power generation as you have need for power, then it's easy to store it and still meet all your demand.
Yeah, yeah. I know that, I think it was last year, Denmark actually hit 140%. They had so much wind energy coming in that they had to sell it to their neighbors. So clearly economically unfeasible.
The other thing is, this is mainly an issue with capitalism, which is we shouldn't really need continuous energy all the time, no matter what. Like, we do have to change our energy consumption habits. I mean, we'll get more into this in the second part again, but intermittent energy isn't so bad if losing energy for a few seconds doesn't cause the entire economy to collapse. You know, obviously there's things that we do need continuously, like, you know, hospitals, but if Starbucks loses power for like a few hours, big deal.
Yeah, it's really not that big a deal. Also, if we then start to look at the patterns of usage, then it becomes very clear that we don't need more than intermittent energy to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the energy that's being produced can very easily be dedicated to the systems that can't be interrupted, but a lot of it can. And at the moment, we're just in this constant production and consumption cycle because that's the way that capitalism requires it to be. Because we need that constant cycle of production and consumption
mm-hmm.
to justify the growth of the economy and the growth of profits and the growth of and growth.
Yeah, look, nothing physically bad would happen if Starbucks did shut down for a few hours. No one would die. People would get over it eventually. But if that did actually happen, then like Starbucks would tank. Like their stocks would go down, their CEOs would jump off bridges.
Wait, I thought you said something bad might happen.
Continuing on wind power, because we were getting a little bit off track.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, we all know about electricity from wind. That's what we all know and love. There's also mechanical power from wind. So windmills used to be literal mills. They milled grain with just the mechanical power generated by the wind. So it was actually hooked up to a gearbox. And as the wind turned the blades, it would turn a mill. And that's where the term comes from. For things like that, there's actually not really any advantage to using electricity other than being able to, you know, have a wind turbine in one place while milling your grain in a different place. But for that, you know, you're taking a big loss on transforming the mechanical power into electricity and transmitting that electricity elsewhere, and then transforming the electricity back into mechanical energy. So, like, the inclusion of a turbine when you can use just mechanical power adds, first of all, incredible complexity, because wind turbines are pretty complex products. Material requirements, because they require rare earth metals for the magnets, and it adds inefficiency, like I just described. So, where we can use wind for mechanical power, we should be using it for mechanical power directly.
Indeed. I mean, let's face it, the world's largest empire in the 1700s and 1800s was run on wind. We're talking about the Dutch East India Company and their global empire that literally ran everything. If you didn't comply with them, then you couldn't do anything. And without wind, none of that would have been possible.
Without wind, Peter would not have been born in Africa.
But without wind, America never would have got its independence.
True, yeah. Yeah, and so also, when it comes to the intermittence issue, the intermittence of wind is considered a disadvantage, but I think it could be turned into a neutral characteristic if we use it more opportunistically. So this would kind of combine it with automation. If we were to use these intermittent sources to power processes that don't need to be continuous, which I've been calling for a few years economic idle processes, you know, industrial processes that don't have to be continuous, then it doesn't really matter that it's intermittent. You know, if we have like a fully automated grain mill, then as long as it doesn't matter that something stops it at some point, then it doesn't matter that the power that's coming in is intermittent. You know, as long as it's milling everything that you need eventually, As long as you're not starving, then there's no issue with it being intermittent. The only issue is the predictability of revenue that you can get from it, which is a non-issue.
As part of my general daily research routine, I get regular updates on research being done into wind power. And the most common finding or the most commonly looked at aspect of wind turbines is trying to predict the output over a given time span.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gotten really good at it, man. If you go to most government energy agencies, they can tell you for the next year what the estimated energy budget will be for wind power based on the wind currents as they're being measured, based on the number of wind turbines that are stationed in high wind areas.
And so that's the budget of electricity that will actually be generated, or the energy content of the wind itself?
Well, both.
Okay.
Because they can look at the total energy budget that is flowing, and they can look at how much of that can get extracted, how much would be lost in the conversion process, and how much can be stored, how much would be consumed. It's all very detailed at the moment. And as time goes by, we're just getting better with the detailing of this. So anyone that tells you that we can't, that it's unpredictable, doesn't understand statistics or the level of sophistication.
Or their oil company shills.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's an unfortunate amount of those.
Yeah. All right, should we move on to solar?
I think it's time. I think we've covered wind in depth now.
Okay.
Okay, so moving on, we're going to talk about solar now. And just to be clear, solar covers quite a broad array of technologies. Obviously, we get all of our energy from the sun. And how much of that we're able to convert into usable electricity and, usable energy for human purposes. As discussed earlier, there's a certain budget that we can stay within to remain sustainable. So the solar technologies that we're looking at, obviously you've got your photovoltaic, which is the big one in the media, and it's the one that everyone directly knows about.
It's the media darling.
Oh, yes, they absolutely love it. Interestingly enough, I think it was the new solar roof by Elon Musk.
All right, so yeah. I shit on Elon Musk a lot, but I actually think that's pretty cool. I think it's a pretty cool idea.
Definitely. My only issue with it is the coloring. Given the fact that we now know that we can produce solar panels, I'm not sure about the mass production yet, but I do know that we're able to produce photovoltaic panels that are capable of drawing energy from the entire visual spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
They can work in the dark, they can take ultraviolet, they can take infrared.
Visual spectrum. So that's okay.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, you're talking about like multi-junction cells. Yeah, those are, the only problem with those is they're like pretty expensive.
Okay. And the expense issue, I've always said, has a lot to do with how much are people investing in it.
Mm-hmm.
If I produce a multi-cell and nobody buys it in its initial phases, in its the first prototype, if no one buys that first prototype, I don't have the money to then go and develop the next version.
Right.
Sadly, this is the capitalist reality. We can't develop technologies that are good for us unless they are profitable.
Yeah, we need the government to pay for it.
Yeah. Now, the government is subsidizing a fair amount of it, unfortunately. They're also subsidizing a lot of the alternatives to alternative fuels, which is fossil fuels. I think the last thing I saw showed that fossil fuels outstrip renewable subsidies something like 3-1.
Right.
But
that's not including war, which is like the biggest fossil fuel subsidy that there is, which is going to other countries and taking their fucking oil.
And of course, there's the agricultural sector, which has a shitload of subsidies and uses up more of the fossil fuels than any other industry.
True, yeah. Well, does that include the military? Because the military, I think the military is actually the biggest consumer of fossil fuels, like, on the planet.
The problem is that you're not including the transportation costs involved with agriculture.
I see. Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Yeah, once you've made all the fertilizers and stuff that have grown the corn, you then have to transport that corn all over the world. It's hilarious. The cheapest apples that I can get at the local supermarket are South African apples. And I cannot buy those apples in South Africa. They are grown in South... when I was doing a tour around South Africa with my uncle, and one of the farms we stopped off at in the Cape was an orange farm. The guy did oranges and lemons only, and it's in an area of the world that grows some of the most beautiful oranges imaginable, and I'd never seen anything like them. The oranges I was used to seeing in the stores were blemished. They were natural-looking oranges. And here I was, surrounded by these orange trees that had the most beautiful, tasty, luscious, unblemished oranges you'd ever seen in your life. And I'd never seen them, and I was very curious. And I asked the farmer, and he said, "Oh, no, we don't sell to the local market. These are for export only."
Oh, I bet they're going to the Whole Foods in the Bay Area.
pretty much. So we have this transportation system that uses up most of that energy. Be it solar, be it wind, be it fossil fuel, whatever, the transportation networks surrounding agriculture are insane. So yeah, that's one of the reasons why agriculture is so big, is because of the really shitty logistics involved.
All right. Cool.
Okay.
Let's get back to solar.
Getting back onto solar. Okay. So under solar, you've got your photovoltaic. Then you've got solar thermal, which I don't know how big it is. I haven't done a lot of research. I know that in South Africa, there was about 5 years ago, they invested a huge amount of subsidies in purchasing solar water heaters that they then went and installed in what we call informal settlements, which are essentially squatter camps.
That's cool. Okay. So
because there's no generally no running water and no electricity in those areas, what they went and did is they bought hundreds of thousands of these solar water heaters, and they went and they installed them in a whole bunch of underprivileged areas where they then got this. And the advantage of a solar water heater is that there's very little loss of energy in comparison, because you're not converting to electricity and then using that electricity to heat the water, which means you're losing twice over. You're converting the solar heat being captured directly into heat that gets injected into the water. And so it's very efficient. And it's scalable. It's very easily distributed. It's not tied to a grid. There are very many advantages to it.
Yeah, there's estimates about how far solar thermal technology could go, especially for... So there's... You might have seen solar thermal before on someone's roof. It kind of looks like a black box with a bunch of pipes going through it, and so that's just normal solar thermal. There's also concentrated solar power, which uses mirrors to focus thermal energy onto a smaller area, and so parabolic troughs are actually the oldest. I think they might be the oldest solar technology. I mean, if you're not counting like evaporation ponds and stuff like that, but the oldest solar energy technology is the parabolic trough. And it basically takes a parabolic mirror, which is facing, like, it's the concave part is facing up, and there's a pipe at the focal point that's full of hot water, or I think sometimes they have molten salts. And so the sun
molten
gets concentrated onto that pipe and heats up the water, molten salt, whatever the medium is, and then that's used for heat energy. There's also solar power towers.
which if you've never seen one, Google it right now. Like Google Gemasolar, G-E-M-A-S-O-L-A-R. They're extremely cool looking. They look like sunflowers with like lasers going towards the middle.
They are ridiculously cool. I think they used one in the movie with Matthew McConaughey. I think that was one of the only times I actually saw it being used. And there, they were applying it to the destruction of toxic waste.
Okay.
Because of the extreme temperatures. It was set in Mali, I think it was.
Okay. Yeah, Gemasolar plant, I think, was in Spain. And I think they were going to build, like, a second version in, like, Arizona or somewhere like that.
I know that South Africa has three. I know there are
really?
A few. Okay. Yeah. It's one of the best investment energy power plants that there is. So there's a lot of new ones going up. The technologies involved with it are absolutely brilliant. In some cases, they've managed to develop the storage that goes with the plant, especially with molten salt storage. They've managed to develop it to the point where they've now got, I think it's up to 36 hours of storage.
Nice. Okay.
So there's no interruption in power supply. And obviously these are being put up in areas that get 90% sunshine throughout the year. There's almost no downtime. 24-hour a day power provision and very little drawback. The only real issue that they've had is similar to wind turbines with wildlife, specifically birds.
Oh yeah, they're death rays for birds, which I kind of think is cooler than bad.
To be honest, what I find most interesting about that is the solutions that they've come up with. Very similar to with big wind power plants, the solution is ridiculously simple. They've gone and studied what are the birds that are frequenting those areas. They've then gone and looked at what are the predators for these birds. They've then gone and found recordings of the predators of these birds, and they now just play them over a PA system surrounding the power plant, and none of the birds go anywhere near because they really don't want to get eaten by their predators. So there's a very low-tech solution.
See, now I'm imagining you go to, like, a solar power tower, and you think it's going to be, like, this cool humming, and you walk up, and it's just like, meow.
Oh, that is so good. I like that.
So currently, concentrated solar power is more expensive than photovoltaics, so it's not quite competitive with it.
Yeah, just to be clear, the reason that it's so expensive is not because of the production of the troughs or the towers. It is the time that it takes to recoup.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Your investment. Because the energy, once it's up and running, because it's so cheap, they can't sell the energy for a whole hell of a lot.
Uh-huh, okay.
Okay, they can't justify it other than, oh, it cost us this much to build the power station.
Right.
So what they're selling the energy for isn't competitive because they're pushing the prices up because they need to recoup their investment. It's got nothing to do with whether or not the technology works or
is sustainable. So subsidies would probably make it cheaper, is what you're saying.
Subsidies would make it so competitive that there is no coal or oil station that could compete at all.
Yeah, ever. Yeah. So that what I was going to get to was that there are predictions that, you know, even without subsidies, technological advances, mostly in the technology for the mirrors, because they're fairly expensive, they could get as low as 6 cents a kilowatt US, which is cheaper than coal. Coal is like 8 to 11 or something like that. Pretty cool, I think.
And if you then go and include subsidies on top of that,
right,
then you're looking at a ridiculously low price, sitting closer to the 2 or 3 cents a kilowatt level. So yeah, again, we're looking at a technology that is light years, excuse the pun, ahead of archaic fossil fuels, excuse the pun again. Both were intended.
All right, man. Should we talk about nuclear now?
Yeah. I'm going to just say right off the bat that I'm not a fan of nuclear because I'm anti-science.
Have you heard about thorium? Have you heard about Have you heard about thorium, sir? Sir, have you heard about thorium?
Are you talking about our energy and savior, thorium?
Yes. you need to Google thorium reactors right now. The thorium fuel is extremely abundant. You don't need any weapons-grade nuclear fuels. Produces no waste at all. The government is actually keeping this from you, as well as big oil. And if you're against thorium, you are anti-science and you're as bad as a climate change denier.
That is true.
Yes, it's true. All really completely am. True. Google it. Google energy from thorium.
Okay, so the main reason...
You can actually power your cars with it.
Okay, I won't get into the main reason why I'm against nuclear until next week, because then we're going to be talking about the aspects of energy.
Spoilers. That,
yeah. Spoiler alert. Next week, I will explain in detail why I am not a big fan of nuclear. But for now, here's Ryan, and he's going to tell you more about nuclear.
All right, kids. Nuclear is a pretty good option, and we're too far into the threat of climate change to be concerned that it produces a fairly small environmental hazard compared to the incredibly large hazard of climate change, ocean acidification, and all those things that we talked about with planetary boundaries. Someone that went on Seriously Wrong, shout out to friends of the show, Aaron and Sean, who run the Seriously Wrong podcast. Check them out. They're great. So they had a guest on there that was talking about nuclear power, and he pointed out that nuclear power is strongly associated with socialism, which I think is pretty true because nuclear power is really not a viable business. I mean, first of all, it takes like 10 years to build a nuclear reactor, something like that. Mm-hmm. So you need, you know, huge, like low interest loans or subsidies in order to finance the project while it's under construction. When we originally recorded this, I hadn't seen the payback time for a nuclear plant, so I thought it was actually pretty quick, but while editing, I've looked it up, and the payback time is actually 30 years or more, which means on top of having to spend 7 to 10 years building the plant, it takes over 3 times as long just to break even, and so it's considered a very risky investment. Yeah, so you basically need the government to get involved in order for nuclear to work. And if you have it as a business, there's also the issue of... I mean, it's kind of funny, but it's also kind of nightmarish. Businesses run out of money to decommission the reactors. When they're run by private businesses, when it's time for the reactor to be shut down because it can cause like huge, massive problems, businesses don't have the money to do it. The only way nuclear is successful is with a sort of socialist bent. I mean, I don't want to say that anything the government does is socialism, but if the government is doing stuff in favor of social ends, making public resources, I think that's as close to socialism as we'll get in the near term. And so I think that nuclear is a good option because, it produces a lot of power, produces it all the time, it's not fossil fuels, the environmental hazards are relatively small compared to fossil fuels, and it's associated with socialism, and socialism is cool.
Socialism is cool. Okay, so I just have a few questions.
Okay.
In our private discussion before the show, you were talking about the new kinds of nuclear power stations, not the thorium reactor specifically.
Right. There's like several generations of nuclear reactor. It's generations 1 through 4, and the first generations, I think we never even built those. The ones that we have in current use are Gen 2 or 3, but there's Generation 4 reactors, fast breeder reactors, which create fuel using like essentially what would be waste for an earlier generation reactor. They use neutrons emitted from fission directly without having like moderation, so like older plants, they slow those neutrons down before they use them.
Which itself obviously uses energy.
Right, yeah. So the basic gist is the reactors are safer, they're less complex, and they can use fuels that would not be viable for other generation reactors.
In essence, a nuclear reactor is different from a steam engine in what way?
The only real difference is the source of heat.
Yeah. So essentially, we've got these really amazing technological marvels doing something that we've been doing for, what's it, close to 200 years now. It boggles my mind a little bit, because as advanced as we are in our ability to fission atoms and harness their energy, we're not really harnessing all that energy, are we? We're busy converting it in two or three different stages,
right,
to eventually extract a little bit of electricity. I mean, we must be talking about a huge...
It's a lot of electricity.
No, fair enough. But in comparison with the sheer amount of energy that is being released by these fission reactions, what are we talking? What's the conversion rate?
That I actually have no idea about.
The Nuclear Energy Institute states that nuclear energy is the most efficient of all electricity sources. Gee, I wonder if the Nuclear Energy Institute is biased towards nuclear.
No.
Yeah, definitely not. They reckon that nuclear energy facilities have the highest average capacity factor among all U.S. electricity sources. But fuel costs are closer to 80 or 90% when electricity is produced by burning coal or natural gas. So, it's a bit of a tough one. If we're comparing to fossil fuels, almost everything fails. Because, I think as we discussed in our last podcast, the cost is not being calculated properly because we're not busy looking at environmental costs. We're not looking at your externalities. So, if all of that is included, I think, obviously, almost everything beats fossil fuels. In other words, I'm just saying that I don't think it's that fair to compare nuclear to fossil. I think it needs to be compared to something that is at least in the same ballpark when it comes to potential waste. And then we're looking at the next one down, which would be geothermal, which comes in at approximately 71%.
Efficiency and of conversion of the energy to electricity? Is that what you're saying?
No, now I'm talking about capacity factor. That's the ratio of actual power generated versus the maximum possible.
Okay.
Nuclear does about 92.2%.
I see.
Whereas geothermal runs at 70.7%.
Okay.
Now, they reckon that gas and coal run at about 56 and 54%. Solar is as low as 28. Wind is as high as 32. And then oil is as low as 14.7. But again, I have no idea whether these are accounting externalities. I don't know if they're talking about pure energy conversions. I don't know if they're talking about the conversion of the energy released in the fission process being then converted into steam, being then converted into electricity, and the heat losses involved. I'm not sure.
Yeah, too many metrics.
It's some of my minor concerns when it comes to nuclear. I've never been a fan, and I think one of the major reasons why I started disliking nuclear, because I didn't have an opinion on it a few years ago, but then the South African government went and did a very shady deal with the Russian government to have several nuclear power plants built in South Africa. South Africa already has one nuclear power plant called the Kooburg Station, which has had several scares already. But these new power stations, interestingly enough, were not going to supply any jobs to South Africans. They were going to bring in specialists from Cuba to build the plants.
Interesting.
And bringing in workers from Russia, from the Ukraine, from everywhere except South Africa. Specifically because South Africa, over the last two decades, has stopped having the engineering capacity to do these major technological projects because of a lack of infrastructure in our education system. So I disliked nuclear for corruption reasons. I felt like there was very little accountability on the making of these deals and so on. And that's why I started looking further into nuclear and its potential pitfalls.
So that's a counterpoint to the Socialism Association argument, because there was a guest lecturer from, can't remember if he was a Chinese national and studied in Korea, or if he was Korean, but a guy who went to York University, to one of the Capitalist Power lecture series, and he was talking about this big problem in Korea that sparked all these protests at the time, where they actually, in South Korea, most of their energy comes from nuclear, and there are nuclear mafias, and you basically like cannot criticize the nuclear industry at all. Like, you can't do activism against them at all without getting in some serious shit. And so there was this town outside of Seoul, kind of nearby, if I remember correctly, and they have like four nuclear power stations near them, and one of them is getting very old, and there was a report that said that it was at pretty high risk of melting down. And so they obviously were like, we want you to do something about the nuclear power plant that might melt down, like, right next to our town. And they kind of tried to silence them, and so it sparked all these protests. I tried to follow up on it a while ago and wasn't able to find much information about it because, you know, it's Korea, so we don't have a whole lot of news about it. But yeah, I thought that was that's probably a good counterpoint against the socialism argument, is that you could also, it could also be a like mafia thing.
Yeah, well, let's be honest. Before we attribute the issue to socialism, let's just say that anytime authoritarianism gets to poke its nose into any kind of situation, you will have major corruption issues coming up. And it's not an issue that is based on socialism, but rather an issue based on authoritarianism and the abuse of power. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's not real socialism.
So I think nuclear, it's better than oil and gas and coal, but
yeah.
Is it as good as our renewable sources?
Well, of course not.
I'm not so sure. I'm not sold.
Yeah, I mean, the main advantage it has is that it can provide that baseline power 24/7. That's the main reason that we would want it. And it uses very little land for the amount of energy that it generates.
In comparison, yeah,
yes.
I'm sure. There is one other issue I wanted to bring up the moment you mentioned Korea.
Okay.
Is Korea pretty close to the Ring of Fire?
I have no idea. I'm not sure what you mean.
The Ring
of
Fire.
Are you talking about that
natural gas pit? No. Oh, okay. The Ring of Fire is basically the outer rim of the Pacific Ocean.
Oh, okay.
It is a series of fault lines that, when they get disturbed, really bad shit happens.
Yes,
like
that is
Shima.
That is why the plant was at a high risk of meltdown, is because it was like right on a fault line. Thanks. Yeah,
and
I totally forgot about that bit.
So I'm like looking at nuclear and I'm saying, awesome. It runs 24/7. It doesn't take up much land. However, much like wind and solar and pretty much any power, there are negatives. There are major negatives, mm-hmm. and there are major limitations. You can't put them just anywhere you want. You have to avoid fault lines.
Yeah, well, you probably shouldn't build anything really important on a fault line anyway.
Yeah, but we're not listening to this stuff at all. when Korea, which is, it's got several fault lines, but I don't think they're as active as the Japanese fault lines or the San Andreas fault line or stuff like that. But it doesn't have to be as active. All it needs is one major catastrophe, and there goes an entire nation's energy sector.
Yeah.
Yet another reason for me to not like nuclear.
Yeah. I mean, like, let's be honest. The real reason that most of us don't like nuclear is because we're leftists, and that's like the correct leftist position, is to be against nuclear power.
Exactly. I was raised to be anti-right, and so I must be automatically wrong. Okay, so I just wanted to very quickly have a chat about some other energy sources, namely geothermal energy, hydro energy. And shall we call it combustion? Shall we call it wood?
Yeah, coppiced wood energy.
Okay, let's start off with geothermal energy. It is easily one of the most efficient energy sources on the planet. The problem with geothermal energy is that it's not really viable in all areas. In some cases, the thermal energy or the thermal differentials required for a geothermal station to produce sufficient energy, the thermal differences are so deep underground that it just makes no sense to go after that energy. It would cost in excess of what we would get back out in the next 50 years. It would cost too much to produce that station. However, there are countries like Iceland that have shown just how fantastic geothermal energy can be. Obviously, this doesn't, like I said, it doesn't work everywhere.
Yeah, Iceland has steam shooting out of the ground everywhere.
Yeah. But there are, in countries like the US that are huge, there are a number of areas where it would be viable. So I think that geothermal very, very clearly brings home the concept that you can't have a one-size-fits-all energy solution. Any energy solutions we have going into the future that break away from fossil fuels are going to require a hybrid system that incorporate wind and solar and geothermal and. I just wanted to bring up geothermal specifically because it's one of the most overlooked energy technologies in mainstream discourse. It tends to get ignored because it's only really viable in very select niche areas.
Right. Yeah, and I think we're exploiting like quite a lot of the potential geothermal energy out there.
Yeah.
Like there's not a whole lot more to build.
Yeah, the areas that it does work in are at least 75% covered already.
Yeah. It's almost as bad as hydro.
Haha. Yeah, hydro. As energy efficient as hydro is, I can't speak for other countries. Obviously, I can only speak for South Africa specifically. I haven't done the research on other countries, but I do know that South Africa is now finally down to its final one last wild river left. That means that there is only one river in South Africa where dams have not been built yet, where the energy of hydropower is not being tapped. And I'm sure I don't even have to start in on the ecological impact of damming up a river.
They cause pretty extensive harm to the river ecosystems.
Massive harm. In South Africa, one of the biggest issues that came up before I left the country was the local energy producer is called Eskom. They have a monopoly on the market, and it's a state-run organization. And apparently, right after the 1994 elections, the new ANC government took power, and one of the first things they did was request that Eskom explain how they were going to provide electricity to the country in the years to come. And part of the initial report was to suggest that the coastal areas use tidal power to pump water into water-scarce areas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's happened in the meantime is that those schemes fell by the wayside. They were never really implemented. They were looked at on paper. Some budgets were allocated. Money went missing. And now what you've got is drought and heavy drought in all those areas that would have been supplied water. And it would have been done without touching the more traditional mainstream energy budget of the country. South Africa is run predominantly on coal. And even if we account for all the hydropower and the solar and all the other energy sources, it wouldn't have touched anything. Drought could have been avoided by putting in tidal power, and tidal power would have driven the pumps. But now a lot of the budgetary allocations that were first put together for those tidal, after it went missing the first time, they then went and reissued a whole bunch of plans. And those plans basically decided to go and turn all the rivers in the country into hydropower. And part of that is the Lesotho Highland Scheme, which is one of the biggest hydropower schemes in the world. It is, as far as I know, it is the single sole source of power for the country of Lesotho, which is ridiculously poor.
If you're American like me and you don't know what country he's talking about, it's, we would probably pronounce it Lesotho or something like that.
Lesotho.
Yeah.
Lesotho is a tiny country that is landlocked in the middle of South Africa. It is a mountainous area where the people still live in very traditional tribal communities. They, the main form of transport is still donkeys.
That's cool as hell.
Yeah, it is. But the levels of poverty in the country are a little bit insane. So South Africa, in their magnanimous way of doing things, gave all of this power to Lesotho through the Highlands Water Scheme. And yeah, so that's the sole source of energy. But they don't technically do it for free. We take a lot of the power for South Africa itself. And it's all part of the ecological disaster that is South Africa's hydropower scheme. So as far as renewable energy goes, hydro is not on my list of favorites.
Okay. Referring back to you not being sure about countries outside of South Africa, I know that in the U.S. we've also exploited almost all of our hydro resources. I think China's getting there too. You know, most Western countries will have almost all of their available hydropower exploited. And if you ever see figures about the amount of renewable energy that a country generates, especially those celebratory figures like, oh, we've achieved 40% renewable energy in whatever European country, go look at the energy mix if you can, if they have it available. Look at the energy mix, and it's almost always like 70 to 90% hydroelectricity, and then a tiny fraction of the rest is solar, wind, geothermal, and all that other stuff. So yeah. Hydro is actually like a huge source of renewable, well, what they would call renewable energy, but it completely dominates. But it's actually not that good.
Yeah, just the moment you said it now, for some reason it popped into my head. Renewable energy does not mean that that energy ever gets renewed. Just so we're clear on concepts here. With wind energy, that energy is siphoning off a very, very, very small amount of the total wind energy driving around the planet. And a lot of the processes involved with the use of that energy generates more wind. So as far as renewable energy goes, I've heard it argued that wind is by far the most renewable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, renewable for them just means it doesn't use fuel. It doesn't mean that it's sustainable. It doesn't mean that it doesn't cause ecological harm, which, you know, wind does slightly and solar does slightly and hydro does a lot. Those are not included in the definition of renewable. It just means that it doesn't use fuel.
The last thing we need to discuss with regards to energy sources is combustion.
Right. So people know about biofuels. Everyone in the U.S. knows about ethanol from corn. That was like a big thing back in the day. There's actually a really interesting capitalist power lecture on how subsidies for corn ethanol were basically causing companies to profit off of starvation. I won't get into that, though, because corn ethanol sucks. It's a terrible fuel source. Another less well-known one, but definitely well-known to the growing number of potheads in the U.S., is energy from hemp. It can be processed into biofuels.
Yeah, hemp is pretty energy dense, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And so I'll refer back to hemp in a minute. There's also the one that's well known among the tech nerd crowd would be algae fuel, which is basically they build these giant bioreactors that have a bunch of algae in them that turn solar energy into a fuel. And that's a pretty high-tech solution. The last I checked, it was sort of viable. But the one I really want to talk about is coppiced wood. And I think that's probably the most unusual idea that there is here. But it's actually a very low-tech solution. Go ahead.
I'll admit I've never heard of it.
Okay. So if you don't even know what coppicing is, it's basically when you have like a mature tree and you just trim all the branches down to basically the trunk, and eventually that the trimmed off wood will regrow. It regrows into smaller stems, so you know, instead of having huge thick limbs, it's going to have a ton of small thin branches. And
I actually think I've seen that in pine plantations throughout South Africa.
Yeah, if you've ever seen a tree with like a normal trunk and then a bunch of tiny branches instead of like thick limbs like you would normally see, the tree has been coppiced.
Okay.
There's a similar thing called pollarding. It's hard to say. And the only difference is that it's not trimmed back as much as coppiced wood.
Okay.
So for coppiced wood, obviously all you need is trees and the ability to trim the limbs off of them. So the infrastructure requirements are quite low. Coppiced wood can be burned easily, as is. You know, obviously anyone can put wood in their fireplace. It can be used in more industrial type applications just by using a wood chipper. So it's chipped into small fragments, and then that can be used in, you know, some kind of chute, just like you would use coal or something like that. It can also be turned into solid or liquid biofuels. So the versatility of the form of the fuel is very high.
Also, I would imagine that it encourages the growth of these coppiced forests.
Right. Yeah, so that's the other main point that I wanted to make on this. So there's short rotation coppicing, which allows trees to be harvested every 3 to 5 years. So you let them, you let the branches grow out for 3 to 5 years, and then you trim them back again. And those trees can be grown for about 30 years until they have to be replanted. So whereas hemp, first of all, you can't really burn it as is.
Well, you can.
Well,
but
yeah. Not for electricity. So you have to process hemp into something else before you can use it for energy. But also, you have to plant it every year because it's an annual crop. So while you don't have hemp growing, and while you're not in the growing season, you just have a bunch of bare soil. And bare soil is really bad for both, you know, ecosystems and for our food security and agricultural security, because while that soil is bare, it's very easily eroded. And so, like, soil depletion is actually one of the biggest issues with food security in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's been estimates that we're basically going to run out of soil by 2100 if we don't change our ways. So having trees that sit there for 30 years, first of all, you know, while they're not fully coppiced, they're providing at least some amount of habitat for birds, squirrels, and that kind of thing. And they're, if not improving soil, they're not depleting soil like an annual crop would.
Yeah, look, I'm sure that there are some knock-on effects, but for the most part, you would probably see reconstitution of soil from that kind of coppiced forest.
Yeah, I mean, every time the leaves grow and drop in the fall, if they're left to rot there, then you have a leaf litter layer, which is an important ecological clade, I think is the term.
It's not clade. That's not even an ecological term.
Yeah, definitely. Over 3 or 4 years, that would form a nice, healthy humus.
Yeah, there's a lot of insects that live in the leaf layer of a forest. And then, you know, of course, most of what we think of as being the source of this coppiced wood nowadays is going to be like a tree plantation where you just have nothing but these whatever type of trees you're growing, you know, just planted in rows, and that's the only crop there is. And it's going to be marginally better than a hemp farm where it's just going to be a bunch of densely packed hemp plants that are there for like, you know, 3 months out of the year and then bare for the other 9. But even better, and we could talk about this in a whole episode, would be a restoration agricultural system where coppiced wood would be just part of a larger system of agricultural products where you're also harvesting food and fiber sources for other purposes and animals as well. So the real advantage of coppiced wood is like the potential that it has to be not only a fuel source, but a fuel source that comes from you know, an industrial system that actually improves the environment rather than being deleterious.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. I do have one quick question that pops up.
Okay.
How biodiverse are these coppiced forests or plantations? Are we talking about a monocrop kind of situation where there's one tree type? Because if I'm thinking of the right thing, if these were coppiced plantations in South Africa, with the pine plantations, and they've got pine and birch are the two main forms of plantations that I see throughout South Africa, and they are coppiced, except for the very top of the tree, the branches are every 3 to 5 years they take off the branches all the way along the side. And then eventually when they harvest the entire plantation, that all goes for planking and lumber and whatnot. But these are single species plantations. So you will have 300 square miles of nothing but pine.
Right.
Which obviously it still allows for a certain level of biodiversity in the forest floor, but the diversity of the entire plantation isn't, like, that wouldn't score very highly.
Right. Yeah, the plant biodiversity is low. The animal diversity could still be pretty decent.
Yeah.
I mean, you still don't have like food crops for like deer and stuff like that, but
Yeah.
So I mean, the biodiversity is can be variable. If it's
okay.
Yeah. We don't need to go too much more into it.
Yeah, the reason I brought it up is because one of the biggest findings from these plantations in South Africa was that they very heavily affect the biogeochemical makeup.
Okay.
In the areas where they are. A pine plantation, for instance, gives off a lot of tannins. So depending on where it gets planted, if it's planted relatively high up on a mountainside, every time it rains, all those tannins alter the pH levels in all the lower lying areas.
Right.
And it can very negatively affect the biodiversity in the surrounding areas.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So it was just something I was curious about, whether or not you'd seen a multi-crop system like this.
Yeah. I mean, the place that I actually learned it from is the book Restoration Agriculture by Merck Shepherd. And so he talks about this as an energy source within an extremely biodiverse system. But the research that I did on this for this episode, I learned from like tree plantation type sources.
Okay. So obviously the book you read was talking about a hypothetical system.
Well, it's not hypothetical because that's where Mark Shepherd gets all the energy for his farm. He gets it from wood that he trims off from trees on his farm.
Okay, but we're not talking about national scale.
Correct. Not yet.
Okay. Okay, but hypothetically speaking, we could be looking at a very biodiverse forest.
Yes.
That gets sustainably harvested for this kind of energy.
Yeah. Ideally.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I think it'd be really cool.
Yeah.
Plus, everyone likes a good fire.
That's been quite a busy episode we've had. We had that that lovely little call from Steve Nuchin. before we covered the look at sustainable versus unsustainable energy, we did explain what we talk about or what we mean when we talk about sustainability. I think we've covered some really nice points on energy sources, whether it's fossil fuels, nuclear, solar. I think, did we cover geothermal energy? No, I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember either.
We touched on it briefly.
We could definitely get more into it because you found some cool stuff after we recorded the first half of the show. And look, we could get more into it later on because like each of these topics are huge.
Definitely.
Yeah, we kind of skimmed through everything.
If our listeners are really keen to hear more about geothermal energy, they can go onto the Neighbor Science Facebook page and they can tell us all about it.
And also tell us if you want the episodes to be more like seriously wrong, or like, you know, something or like the dollop, like something short like that, or like hardcore history where it's going to be like 3 hours of heavily researched stuff.
because...
And yes, please let us know if our voices are irritating and you need us to speak in more elocutive tones.
Yeah, I mean, like, obviously, it's been a long time since we released the last episode. Most of that was because we would get ready to record and be like, oh, shit, yeah, we should have researched a lot more on this topic. So this is our trade-off. We just kind of went with it. We got a
decent
amount.
Yeah, we've done a lot of research. We've done a lot of research. We just don't understand a lot of it, and so we've made it up as we went along.
I spent 8 hours this week reading about pumped hydro storage and managed to get, what, like 3 minutes out of it, something like that.
I managed to read up on ammonia energy storage and distill down about 15 different articles, research articles, down to what I think was a very efficient 2 or 3 minute little explanation.
There's a pun in that use of distill there. So once I started editing this episode, I realized that we already had an hour of content when I was only about halfway through. So we will actually be splitting this into three parts. So part one will be energy sources and sustainability. Part two will be energy storage. And hopefully only part three, and not part three and four, will be energy slavery, the maximum power principle, Jevons paradox, and some other ecological type topics.
Yeah, if anyone listening wants to hear anything else that we haven't mentioned, or if they just want to research so that they can follow us while we speak on these heavily complex topics, or they have a very unusual topic that they think we should look into, they must let us know.
And if we should be doing like professional scale research and making a 3-hour show like Dan Carlin, then definitely let us know. We probably won't, though. Sounds like a lot of work. I have a job. If you want 3-hour shows, donate to our Patreon that doesn't exist yet. Once we get to, what do you say, $4,000 a month, then we'll do hardcore neighbor science.
Yeah, that actually, and please, people, that's $4,000 each.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's what I meant, of course. All right.
Okay, cool.
That's it for part one. Hopefully, we'll get to talk to you again in part two. Yeah. Right.
僕はまたあなたが思わ死んじゃうつもりなのかな。